Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome to another Wasted Saturday Night. I am Josh Hadley. With me, as always, is Glenn British Criddle.
What's up, chaps and chapesses?
There you go, British it up. And and Sarah Los Angeles Hanley. Give us some Los Angelism.
Totally. I can't even think of anything to say.
Okay, that's not Los Angeles, but whatever. All right, well, before we get into the topic, a couple of things. You guys need to go to adamandeve.com. Use the promo code STATIC to get something to stick inside you or to stick you inside of. You go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code STATIC, you will get 10 free gifts. You will get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free U.S. shipping. Also, if you go to drivethroughrpg.com, you can get the Systemless Settings Bundle if you're an RPG player from Al Seeger. He's a really cool guy. Just tell him that Josh sent you, and you'll get some cool stuff. It's drivethroughrpg.com. Now that we got all that out of the way, I wanted to talk to you about something that came out the week we're recording this, and I know Sarah's going to flip her shit over this. Glenn, you're not a comic book guy, but I think this is indicative of a much larger issue. Mm-hmm. Marvel, Disney has announced that the Marvel Universe, which right now is split into mainly the Ultimate Universe and the Marvel Universe, and these are two very different things. They're going to be combining them together because it's too confusing for non-comic book fans to figure out that, like, hey, we just saw the new Thor movie. We go pick up a Thor comic and, wait a minute, that's not the Thor from the Thor movie? You mean the Thor from the Thor movie is in the Ultimate Thor book? But wait a minute, I thought if I just picked up Thor, and wait a minute, why is Nick Fury white in the Marvel comic books? Oh, well, he's black in the Ultimate Marvel universe, so that's the one that the movie is based on. Well, you didn't tell me that as a non-comic book fan. Now I'm confused and I'm not buying your books. Is it right that the Marvel universe in comics is being dumbed down for the mainstream? Sarah, since I know you're a comic book fan, I'm going to go to Glenn first.
Okay.
I don't think it's particularly fair. I can sort of understand it from the business point of view, but I think with the movies and stuff, that's a completely separate product. And, you know, certainly going back to the comics, and it's kind of betraying the people who made it popular when you do that kind of stuff. I don't understand particularly why they've decided to do that, other than they want to make it more accessible to a wider audience. I think they would eventually get it anyway, so I don't see why. I think it's a disappointing decision.
But does accessible also mean altering it? For instance, like the Joker. You had the Heath Ledger Joker in The Dark Knight, and then all of a sudden the Joker in the comic books starts looking like that Joker, because that's the one non-comic book fans know. The X-Men, back in 2000, the X-Men had, in the 90s, they had these wildly colorful costumes. Then the 2000 movie comes out. All of a sudden, the comic book X-Men are all in black and yellow leather, because people who just saw the movie were like, wait a minute, that's not what Wolverine looks like. Where isn't it kind of saying, fuck you, comic book fans? We want the people who are not comic book fans. Isn't that asking the wrong audience, though, Glenn?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they should be true to the source material when it, you know, I mean, you shouldn't be kind of revising all that stuff, I don't think. That's it's a betrayal of what's come before, and certainly it's a betrayal of the fans. I think it is certainly a case of taking that stuff which the fans have, you know, made their own, and essentially going, well, you know, we want to make more money, screw the lot of you. I think that's ultimately a bad decision, though, because when the popularity of the films goes, and the
audience, eventually they will.
Yeah, and when the audience that was attracted to those comics after that have lost interest, which they will, where are you going to be left? The original fans are going to be kind of sat there going, well, you killed off our version of this a long time ago.
Sarah, do you think it's right that instead of making comic books for comic book fans, they're focusing on making comic books for people who are not comic book fans? Does that even make sense on a logical level?
It doesn't make sense on a long-term level, on a business level, on a logic level, and on the level of keeping the trust with your fans. Something else that they did is that when the Green Lantern movie came out, then everyone had those weird, veiny light suits that reflected what the design was in the movie. And
The Green Lantern
after the
costume should
Batman.
not look like my grandmother's legs.
Yeah, that needs to be checked on, both of those. And then when the Batman video games turned out to be really popular, suddenly Harley Quinn is dressing like a slut. That reaches the point where you have two groups of people out in the public that have two different versions. You have the people who remember the 90s one, and you have the people who are playing the video games. And then you have the third group, which is the people who have been reading the comic books. And so they have a continuity. And so you have just fucked over two of them to get the one that you think is going to pick up the comic books. But they're not going to pick up the comic books because they would have to actually find and go into a comic book store. DC, you've done a shit job of trying to convince us to read comic books online. I know that's going to save you money at some point, but you haven't built the audience, which is what they're doing. That they are killing their audience. New 52. And Marvel is trying to do the same thing. It's insane. That it redoing your entire universe is not always a bad thing. It was done well
The
in the
crisis on
80s.
Infinite, yeah, the crisis on Infinite Earths was necessary. 0 Hour wasn't.
No.
Glenn's going, fucking nerds.
Oh, Zero Hour wasn't. And then what they did after that with.
Oh God, the Infinity crap, the Infinity
Oh,
Crisis,
yeah.
and all
And
that,
then
yeah.
Trinity. And then. Why were you doing that every 2 or 3 years? I'm sorry. I'm getting flashbacks. It's not a good thing. Yes, why did you have to have your entire thing that she wanted to get her husband back, and so she shrunk down and gave someone an aneurysm. Why am I not making any of this up?
Why was Sue Dingby raped?
Because we couldn't think of anything else to do.
Well, but
Sounds very soap opera, that does. Sounds absolutely
It
soap opera, that
does.
does, when they have
It
to
is.
throw that drama, that outrageous drama in there to really kind of spice things up. And I know with several of the soap operas over here, there were some which were very, very gentle and about kind of life in the countryside and all this kind of stuff, and then times changed and then suddenly you got aircraft dropping on the village and stuff like that. It's like, kind of,
Yeah,
what
well,
the
at
hell
least
do you think you're doing?
you guys never had passions.
Well,
Passions.
yeah, but
Passions was kind of, what if Days of Our Lives met Dark Shadows?
well, they did have one that crossed over with Doctor Who.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, I'll actually be bringing up Doctor Who later, but let's stick with the comics for right now. Because one of the internal things that I know Disney has not been happy about for years, they love Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury in the movies. But one of the biggest things that they said, one of the reasons that they're doing this is people keep going, why is the Nick Fury in the comics white? And non-fans are going, wait a minute, he should look like Samuel L. Jackson. He should be black. I think that's insulting to the Nick Fury that's been around since the 1960s to go, well, the black one's more popular than you, so you're now getting phased out because people recognize Samuel L. Jackson in that part.
Well, and Josh, you know what they did? They killed him.
He's been dead before, so that's not a big deal.
Well,
remember when the Punisher killed him too?
Well, yes, but they killed him by having him kill the Watcher. I'm not going to listen to anyone who shouts spoilers because you should have read that already.
What do you think about this as the non-comic fan? Do you think, I mean, like, I know you've seen the Marvel movies, so that Nick Fury is probably, you as a non-comic fan, is the one you recognize. Is that right to do that to the Nick Fury that's been around since the 60s, the white guy? And I'm not trying to make this a race issue. I'm just using this to differentiate between the two, okay? I'm not saying the white guy is getting screwed by the black guy, because I know somebody will try to take that out of context. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just using this as an example. Do you think that's right to phase out the version that's been around since the 60s for the new version because that's the movie version?
I think it's a case of the film really ought to be treated as a very different thing. It's a completely different media. And by its very nature, when you make a film from a book, from a comic, from whatever previous source, whether it be a computer game or whatever, you naturally are going to have those kind of changes. And, you know, that's fair enough within the film. When you go back and you start revising the history of the source material, I think you're running into certain problems there, because it's suddenly going, well, our latest version is the superior version, therefore this is what we're going to go with now. We're going to just basically fuck off all the rest of that stuff and just go with what everybody seems to recognize now. And of course, the driving force of it all is, it's pandering to the new audience, the ones that can't be asked to go back into the history of where these stories came from. And that's a real shame. But I mean, it's not actually anything new. If you look at the old fairy tales, Grimm's fairy tales, for instance, you see how those have changed. And they've always been kind of altered and made relevant, I guess, or irrelevant to the newer audience. And if you compare the original tales to what you'll see in any mainstream film now, the two are almost unrecognizable. So it's not a new phenomenon in that respect. But yeah, I think it's particularly disrespectful to the people who have followed the story up until that point, just to go, yeah, well, that stuff that you loved about it is no longer in it.
Steve Ditko's Nick Fury is going, fuck you.
Well, and I think that this is going to be interesting with Spider-Man. If they're doing this, it's completely going to be the reverse of that, because the Ultimate Spider-Man is a black character, but the character that we've seen in the movies is a white character. If they're going to fold everything into the Ultimate Universe, you're going to suddenly have everybody be very surprised and go, but that doesn't look like Peter Parker.
I actually don't think they're going to do that. What I read about this is they're going to combine the two. So in the new Marvel Universe, some will be the Ultimate versions, some will be the 616 versions, and they'll all be in one coherent universe now. So they're probably going to keep the most recognizable versions of each character for that exact reason, Sarah.
Oh, but then they're going to be accused of, well, you didn't want to have a black Spider-Man, so that they're going to keep both of them. I mean, just on a PR standpoint, you think they're going to want to jump on that?
Probably not. Speaking of PR, now, this is one of the things that actually pissed me off the most about how this whole pop culture thing hurts the originals. They've been trying to get a real Django movie made for years. Django's Return. Mike Malloy wrote it, and it's supposed to be, it's Franco Nero coming back as the Django character for an official sequel to the 60s Django. There was already a sequel in 1987, Django Strikes Again, and they want to make a third final Django movie. Do you know why they're not able to find funding for this? Because the population goes, Django's not white, Django's black. The Tarantino fake Django movie has actually hurt the brand of Django, of the original Django, so much so that nobody wants to fund a non-Jamie Foxx Django movie now. I find that insulting. Franco Nero should be pissed off. His legacy has been stolen from him, I think. And keep in mind, I thought Django Unchained was an all right movie. Jamie Foxx was great in the part, and Christoph Waltz was absolutely fantastic in the film. I'm just saying, to the popular culture, that's the Django they know. They've never heard of this Franco Nero guy or the two Django movies he made in the 80s and 60s, respectively. So now we might not get a third one of those because of the Tarantino one being so popular. Is that the way this is supposed to work? Sarah?
It's the laziness of the culture, unfortunately. If the only way that you could do it is a groundswell, if you had independent theater showing the three of them as a block. I don't know if you could get people to sit through that, but if maybe you made it hipster enough, then you would get all of those into the public consciousness, and then they would have a chance.
See, I only watch Django movies with Franco Nero. You know, that's the way I am, Sarah.
Yeah, just pop that collar, won't you?
While I'm wearing my vintage Thundercats t-shirt and eating macaroni and cheese from a trash bin.
Classic.
And those are Turtles macaroni and cheese, thank you. Vintage.
Fair enough. You got anything more to add to this one before I go to Glenn?
No.
Glenn?
I think possibly you give it a few years and then it might be possible. It's going to always be.
And Franco Nero is in his 70s. In a few years, he won't be alive, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. But then again, you know, I mean, you look at how fast films get rebooted, and I mean, how many bloody Spider-Man films do we have to sit through where it's the origin story, for instance? It's possible to do it. I think with something like Django, though, it's a little bit more difficult, possibly because of the. If you're swapping from a black character to presenting them as a white character, politically speaking, that's possibly a bit more difficult.
But he was a white character first.
Yes, I know. I understand what you're saying. But of course, in the public consciousness now, it's going to be a white, just like you say. So that's probably a bit of a stumbling block. But I mean, that's not insurmountable. It's just unlikely, I think, because I think there'd be an awful lot of people who would be a bit kind of leery about, like you say, funding something going in that direction.
Well, then let's move over to your country versus America here with Doctor Who. Now, I've never been a huge Doctor Who fan, but, you know, I grew up watching it on PBS, and, you know, I saw K-9 and, you know, stuff like that. I'm definitely not a fan of the current generation of Doctor Who. I just don't like it. But it seems to me the more popular Doctor Who gets in pop culture, you know, the t-shirts at Hot Topic and there's action figures everywhere, and you're seeing people who would never watch a Star Trek episode as diehard Doctor Who fans, which technically is a good thing. But I think it waters down the brand, because ever since Doctor Who started to get more popular in America, and this is where I don't know if this is the same way over in the UK. As it got more popular in America, it got more violent, more sexual, and more debased, to the point where the Doctor Who I see now, I'm just going, that's not Doctor Who. Or am I just an old man going, no, that's not the Doctor Who I grew up with? What's the difference there, Glenn? Do you think Doctor Who's been kind of watered down as the mainstream accepted it, or am I just screaming at clouds?
The series, as it is... I mean, I remember when they started redoing it again, you know, when they started up the series again, and it was...
Isn't that 04, 05
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, somewhere around there, and it completely, completely different to the classic Doctor Who series in look, in feel. It's inherently a lot more cinematic, for one thing, a lot slicker. The originals were... very, very basic, as was the thing with an awful lot of BBC TV series. But it was always a series that concentrated an awful lot more on atmosphere and the story. It's not always successfully. There's obviously bad episodes from the classic series. But I think the Doctor Who that you see these days is not what I would class as the classic. It's certainly, it's a completely different thing. So I hate to use the word, it's a reimagining. So yeah, I think I'd be interested to see what fans of the current series think of the classic series before I could actually comment any more sort of...
I would think they look at it as sort of kitschy.
Yeah, and it was, to be fair. But it had its moments. I remember being quite scared of certain moments in it. Cybermen in it were always very
those
creepy.
Giant,
and
those
kind of
spider
stuff.
Things?
Yeah, yeah. And the Daleks. It was all very creepy, and somehow it kind of worked on that level, which, you know, to be fair, probably if you try to do it like that these days, people are kind of spoiled by the special effects that are available these days. So watching something like that these days probably wouldn't have the same effect. So it, to some extent, they kind of had to update it,
Except now, I know you guys got this as a special, but do you think times have changed from 2004 to 1996 when they made the Fox TV pilot with Eric Roberts as the Master? That didn't work. The fans hated that one, and yet I see everything that I don't like about the current version, it was in that one too. Do you think just in 1996 they weren't ready?
It's quite possible. I mean, there's been several occasions, hasn't there, in the past where TV series have been tried to be revived, and it's sort of just fallen on its asses because for whatever reason the people that were making it didn't get the feel right, or the audience was just not kind of ready to have that.
Eric Roberts as the Master. Let me repeat that.
Yes, which is just bizarre. But, yeah, I think, you know, I mean, there's always a right time and a wrong time for these kind of things. And I think if, for instance, I've known something like Twin Peaks, I think the time has sort of come to the point where people were looking back at the original and going, actually, I'd really like to see that sort of come back, and perhaps the audience is ready for it this time. Hopefully, you know, on this occasion, it'll find the audience more readily. But I kind of get the horrible feeling with that when it comes out that there will be this similar kind of effect like with Doctor Who, where something will change, you know, whether it's production values, whether it's the quality of the story. I kind of get the feeling that something might change with this. So I'm looking forward to something like that with, shall we say, certain reservations.
Sarah, what do you think? Do you think it actually hurts Doctor Who to have, like, you know, five different T-shirt designs in Hot Topic next to Flash in the Pan band T-shirts?
Oh, it does water it down, but I will say that for some reason, I think it's because the show is popular enough to keep it in the consciousness. Did you notice that there are episodes of The Old Who that have resurfaced only in the last few years, to the point where people even have conspiracy theories that the BBC never burned them, they just had no interest in putting them out, which
I've
would
heard
not
that
make
too.
Sense.
It's very coincidental how the BBC always seems to accidentally find one of the lost episodes right as the new season's about to start and Doctor Who is in the news again. Isn't that funny?
Of course, Gwen knows nothing about this.
Actually, with the BBC have a very massive archive, so it is quite possible that there's stuff in there that they just don't know about. There's, you know, stuff sort of gets hidden away in the vaults and comes out. But, you know, I guess there is some possibility that there's occasional ones that they find and they just go, oh, let's just wait for the right time to release this. Which is fair enough.
Well, and one of the things that I don't think this has ever been put together as something to mention, but the 90s Doctor Who, I think that one of the problems that it had is that there wasn't any willpower behind it. Because the first episode of the first season of Doctor Who came out at the same time as Kennedy got shot. And they decided that after they didn't get the ratings because the President of the United States got shot, let's reshow that episode.
Clinton got blown around that time.
Yes, but that wasn't the thing that killed it. The thing that killed that movie slash episode was that it was at the same exact time slot as Dan on Roseanne got a heart attack. Those two things are not equal in their importance. But because it didn't get the ratings that they wanted, they never showed it again, and they scrapped the entire project.
So then my question to you is, let's say that 1996 Eric Roberts Doctor Who had taken off. Let's say for whatever reason it was a hit. Do you think that Doctor Who would have entered the mainstream consciousness? And I mean the mainstream, not just, you know, people who were watching the X-Files and stuff like that at the same time on Fox. I mean like the pop culture consciousness with Doctor Who jokes on The Tonight Show and shit like that kind of consciousness.
You saw the amount of Judge Ito jokes that were on at about the same time. I think that it would have had lots of playing cards and stickers, and it wouldn't have become as big as it is now because we didn't have the internet for people to just egg each other into a foaming madness, and fan fiction was not as big at that point. Yeah, they like to tease that as much as Sherlock does, don't they? But I don't know, the crazy Doctor Who fans that are out there, which none of them have my address, which is a good thing, they seem to remind me the closest to bronies, which both of them have a show that is on the air right now, and it is only the show that's on the air right now is the thing that they focus on. They don't want to know any history of the property before the time that it became now and important, because none of that means anything to them. Even if someone, it blows my mind as a person who I write and I read
and I draw
and I want to know more about these characters. That's why I have read the first couple of adventures that had Rocky Raccoon in it, and I'm not going to call him Rocket because in the first damn issue that he was in, he introduced himself as Rocky Raccoon, and he was also smoking a pipe, and he also had a funny little accent, which I think they were going for like British, so think of that. But it's so vapid, and it does kill some of my appreciation for the current product that's in front of people, because if you have these people who don't even care about the history of the thing that they say that they really are interested in, I can't see that as anything that's deep or meaningful or is going to be sustainable, because what's now is not going to be there later, because as they said in Spaceballs, this is now. That was then.
When Bill Maher is making Groot jokes on Real Time with Bill Maher, and yet I'm going to go out on a limb and say he's never read a Guardians of the Galaxy comic that was printed before 2010, it kind of deflates the meaning of it, doesn't it?
Oh, come on. You know he didn't read it. He has staff writers for that.
That's true. Well, Glenn, since Doctor Who was way more popular in the UK, I'm going to pose the same question I just posed to Sarah about the 1996 Doctor Who. Let's say for some reason it took off in America and you guys liked it. I know they barely released it over there. I know they kind of snuck it out on like some weekend and then put it out on video. I know they barely put it out in the UK either. But let's say for the sake of this argument, it had been a hit. Do you think it would have entered the pop culture consciousness the way the current version has?
Possibly. It's a bit of a weak answer, I know. It's obviously it didn't, but if it had been popular, then yes, it would have become something a lot bigger than it did. But the thing is, I mean, when you start doing this kind of stuff, when you re-release these things and you're looking for a new audience, there's an awful lot of this trying to find, fumble around for stuff which is popular. And I think we're like Guardians of the Galaxy and the various things like Spider-Man and all that kind of stuff. They tend very much just to go, oh yeah, we'll certainly find something which is popular, and kind of ignore all the substantive things which have been going on in the history of those characters. I mean, this is probably why we've got so many reboots and all that kind of stuff which have been going on. And I always despair every time that you get these kind of like, oh yeah, we're going to reboot it, we're going to take a completely different approach. Because you sort of look at it and you go, well, what about all this stuff that's happened before? What about all these things that we've grown to like about this? Are you just going to go back over the famous stuff or the stuff that you consider to be most interesting and the stuff that the audience out there already knows just because you know you can sell that? I mean, like with comic books and stuff like that, you've got all that history. And unfortunately, when it becomes comes into the popular eye, all that history is, you know, pretty much blown off because they've got to start the story all over again. And it tends to be kind of dumbed down because they know it's got a short shelf life. And I think this is why, for instance, with the Sam Raimi films, you know, of Spider-Man, why they petered out and they started it again, you know, and it's all started from the beginning again. And it devalues kind of what potential these stories have because you're just rehashing old ground and just changing the color palette of the blinking film stock or something like that.
How many times does Superman's fucking origin need to be told on film?
Exactly. You know, I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous to have to keep sitting through this stuff. They go, oh yeah, we're trying to find a new audience, or oh, we wanted to go in a different direction. Fine, you don't have to start right from the beginning. Everybody knows where Superman came from. Everybody knows where Spider-Man came from. You don't need to rehash it every 6 years, 8 years, whatever. It's just kind of, it makes me despair because we're not getting new movies. We're just getting just rehashes.
Sarah?
And Glenn? What I've noticed with New Who is that when they run out of ideas, they do go back to the old Who and they grab bits and pieces. So now you have things that are canon but not canon because they liked the idea of something or just the shininess of something, and they just decided to throw that into their series because they couldn't be bothered to think of something else. So now you have all of these stories that make no sense if you want to see it as an entire continuing storyline, which from the little weird specials that they do, that the thing where they showed all of the doctors and they CG'd their faces onto anonymous actors, we're supposed to think that it all continues from beginning to end. And there is no way in hell that it's going to happen. Are they going to have a crisis on Infinite Earth just to explain the history of the Doctor at this point?
Yeah.
And are they also going to include the Canine Chronicles?
But that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, certainly when even before it becomes a massive public massively into the public attention, you always have these problems with canon. It's just one of those things. It's very difficult. I think it's probably a little unrealistic to expect this sort of bulletproof narrative to run through decades worth of television or decades worth of comic books. You have to let a certain amount of that go. But yeah, sometimes it can just be the case that they just go, well, you know, just throw it out the window, screw it, we don't actually care about that, and pretend it didn't happen.
Lost.
That's a little bit more, yeah. That's the more disrespectful end of it. You know, I think writers ought to try to avoid doing that, you know, as a kind of cynical get out of jail free card.
Well, speaking of like the cynical nature of this whole thing, what about like how even though Grindhouse the film didn't exactly work, I enjoyed Planet Terror. I loved the fake trailers, but it was not the hit that they were expecting. But still, what we call Grindhouse films, exploitation films and whatnot, entered the popular culture in a way we had never seen before. Do you think that has watered them down? Because I do. I think when your general guy off the street even knows what Lady Snowblood is, that actually hurts the incredible quality of a film like Lady Snowblood, because these are the same people who make the Transformers movies popular, and they're looking at this movie not as if they had run across it at 3 a.m. on a local station, they would have passed right by it. But because Tarantino said it's cool, now it's cool. I think that mainstreaming of exploitation or mainstreaming of the grindhouse has hurt grindhouse films. But again, I'm just an old man yelling at a cloud. Glenn?
Yeah, there's a certain devaluation of it in certain circles, I think, when people kind of latch onto something that you've loved despite the fact that everybody else has hated it, and then suddenly everybody goes, oh, yeah, now it's cool. And you kind of do kind of look at people like that and go, really? Are you just saying that or just because it's fashionable? And, you know, I mean, it's the same as any fashion at the end of the day. When it's it'll be big for so long, and then it will sort of peter out and disappear. But these films will still be in the hearts and collections of people who are genuinely interested in them. And I guess it's like, kind of, you know, we consider these little films to be our diamonds, but if, you know, suddenly the popularity is somebody finds a diamond mine with a 1 mile wide diamond in it, you know, and suddenly everybody's like kind of got a piece of it. And yeah, the value of it to some diminish. But, you know, I mean, certainly with the kind of films that I like, which are, you know, usually very obscure, sometimes they get back into the public attention and everybody's like, oh, yeah, I love that film, I love that film, I love that film. And you kind of go, oh, it used to be mine. But it's got a special part in the hearts of various people, those people who have found it, shall we say, the hard way, and have made it part of their culture. I think that it will always be something valuable to those people, because in the pop culture world, it will go eventually. It will disappear.
What do you think, Sarah?
I'm split on this, because films, they need to be almost curated, some of them. You need to have that friend who drags you to their house and shows you the thing and make sure that you see it under the right conditions. But if you have people who are smart enough, then if something gets mentioned, then they go out of their way, they actually find it, and then they watch it and they enjoy it, and they're better for it. For me, the first time that I had ever heard of Legend of the Overfiend was because someone had mentioned it on TV, and then I saw it, I laughed my ass off, I happened to run into the guy who wrote it, and that was an amazing experience, because I was able to tell him to his face that he had made something that I really enjoyed. So to have the knowledge that these things exist out there is a positive. To have people who will say that it's cool because they hear that other people say it's cool, or to just look down the wiki of it and go, oh yeah, now I know what it is and I don't have to watch it. Those people need to be hit in the head with a brick, because they're missing the entire point of it. You don't watch a movie for a one page of a description of it. You watch a movie to have an experience. And I'm not saying that people should be forced to watch movies, because that would also be wrong and slightly illegal. But I do look forward to the point where it's already been dispersed out that this thing exists, and then you have the people who find it and enjoy it, and then through that, through the actual act of watching the damn thing, have enhanced society as a whole. And yes, I did just mention an anime where people get tentacle raped as my subject of how that happened, but it also applies.
But isn't there an inherent arrogance to, and I mean, it's always good when people find these older things, especially if it's something from before they were born. It's not their fault they didn't see it. But isn't there kind of an inherent lack of respect when, say, you know, these filmmakers that made all these exploitation films spent their whole career struggling to pay their rent, and then 5 years after they're dead, their films are selling more than they ever did in the 20 years prior. Or you've got these punk bands who constantly struggled. All the band members are dead, and now some scumbag record executive put their song in a cell phone commercial, and they've got 1 million downloads on iTunes. Isn't it kind of insulting that you don't give these people any respect when they can use it? But after the fact, you go, that guy was a brilliant filmmaker. He just wasn't recognized in his time. Yeah, because you wouldn't recognize him in his time. That bothers
me. Van Gogh.
So, Sarah, your thoughts on that? Or I am, because that really does bother me when I see, you know, I see these authors who their movies or their books are now being made into $100 million films. And these guys spent the last 5 years of their lives living on one meal a day because they couldn't sell anything. You know, that bothers me.
I would hope that because we have more ways of putting content out and anything that is on the internet, this actually works in our favor now. Anything on the internet is forever. So if you put something out and it's good and okay, let's say that you die before it gets recognized. It's going to get recognized before it would have before. As I had mentioned, Van Gogh. Van Gogh tried to settle his debts to a butcher with a painting because he had no money.
William
and how
S.
much
Burroughs.
Do those go for now?
William S. Burroughs. His books are more popular now than they ever have. He lived the last decade of his life in absolute destitution. I don't think that's fair. And I know the internet and fairness don't go together at all, but it angers me that, you know, you people couldn't have found his shit when he could have used some sales? I don't know. Glenn,
I'm not disagreeing with you at all.
This one does anger me about how the mainstream only seems to find this shit after the fact, you know?
Well, I mean,
the mainstream is always going to be the last adapter.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't become mainstream until, you know, I mean, it's always going to be kind of in the background until it becomes mainstream. And it's a weird thing, you know, I guess that when somebody's died or they're not around, that people sort of pick up on it. Maybe that's just the benefit of hindsight. I mean, you can see it to a lesser extent with John Carpenter's The Thing, for instance, which was, as you know, panned on
its release.
It was
a monstrous disaster in 82.
Yeah, it absolutely bombed. And it took a few years for it to really kind of find its audience. I think there's certainly an amount of that going on. You do get, obviously, the dead celebrity kind of effect as well, where people suddenly go, oh, well, I forgot about that person. I'm going to check their stuff out. And then suddenly it becomes a lot more popular. So,
isn't that the same way in film, though, with smaller films? Like, you know, Cutting Class. It's just an obscure slasher film starring Martin Mull and this guy named Brad Pitt in his first film role back in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, it came, it went. Nobody made a big deal about it. Then after Thelma and Louise, it gets massively released on video. Mm-hmm. Isn't that kind of insulting to all the people who made this, the writer and director of Cutting Class – basically couldn't work again after the failure of that movie, but then because, well, it's got this Brad Pitt guy in it, now all of a sudden it's selling 1 million units? Isn't that kind of insulting?
It is, but that's just how it is. I mean, you get films which have been made by a bunch of unknowns, then suddenly one of them becomes famous, and of course people are going to be looking back at that kind of stuff because they're aware of it. You can't really say that the entire audience, it needs to be immediately found. It just doesn't work that way if you're kind of down the bottom end of the market. Should I say? That sounds very detrimental, but it's not supposed to be. If you're lesser known, then obviously people are going to struggle to find your work, and they might not even appreciate it when they do find it until later, where they give it a little bit more of a fair chance. I think that's kind of human nature to some extent. And yeah, I mean, we're like a lot of the films that I've looked at in my reviews and stuff. Many of them, so many of them, were given such a hard time when they first came out, to the point of being treated as possibly criminal, or certainly being dismissed as just being utter trash.
Would you
Then
say
later
that the
they found their
reviewers
audience.
of them were nasty to them?
Very much so. I think I Spit on Your Grave, for instance, is a very good example of a film that's, when it first came out, was absolutely pilloried.
It was
And it is.
reviled, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, and it still is to a certain extent. But now you've got this body of reviewers that have kind of looked at this film and went, actually, there is something here, and including feminist film reviewers who have looked at this film, which was, pretty much called absolute misogyny and all that kind of stuff. And now
Its
you've got
original
feminist
title was
reviewers
Day
looking
of
at
the
it.
Woman.
Yeah. But that's the marketing end of it, though, isn't it? They suddenly went, go, yeah, that's not going to sell.
I well,
I Spit on Your Grave.
you have to admit, I Spit on Your Grave is a much catchier title than Day of the Woman, you know?
It is. It is. And of course, Joe Bob Briggs, which is, you've got to say it in the right way, I Spit on Your Grave.
But you've got these things where you've got people like Tom Hanks, as Sarah pointed out to me in text here, in the ma on Mazes and Monsters, and you've got Brad Pitt, and they're still doing this. The only reason Cabin in the Woods and the Red Dawn remake got released was because Thor is in it. Both of those films sat on the shelf for years, being called unreleasable, and then, holy crap, Thor is in these. We've got two unreleased Thor movies. And so all of a sudden they come out to, not, a claim, but to massive audiences. And I just find that kind of insulting to all the people who worked so hard on these movies. And the only reason anyone gets to see it is because Thor is now popular.
But do you think that if those films had been released at the time that they were made, that they would have found an audience? Do you think they would have made
Well,
any
both
money?
of those films were shit, so they shouldn't have found an audience, but.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the thing. The film has, on the flip side of the coin, the film's actually benefited from the fact that people have looked back at this thing and go, ah, actually, there will be an audience for this. It might be for the wrong reasons, but the film's actually finally made it out. So, yeah, it can seem disrespectful to the original potential release. However, if it wasn't going to get very far, it probably did it some good to sort of hold it back until there was a reason for an audience to buy it. Whatever
Sarah?
that reason may be.
Sarah?
Well, one of my favorite black and white films still has not had a DVD release of its own. And I'm going to explain this because it got a
Reefer
remake,
Madness
and the
is on
remake was
DVD.
absolutely. Okay, you're going to shut up now because you haven't seen this movie. Maybe Glenn has. Death Takes a Holiday. Death Takes a Holiday
Haven't.
was remade as Meet Joe Black. Ah, see? And the only release that they've ever had is on the special edition of Meet Joe Black, and I don't want to give them any of my money. The
Oh, you mean that
original black
fucking
and white.
sleeping pill? God, was that movie boring.
Yes. Yes, but in the black and white one, they have these amazing in-camera practical special effects that they do, and they have a main female character who is not an idiot back in the 40s, and this thing has no audience, but it got a remake, and the remake was so bad that people still don't know about the original.
That's kind of the same way with Brewster's Millions. Nobody knows that that's a remake, the Richard Pryor movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but the only spot of hopefulness that I had to cull my brain for was, do you remember how horribly botched the release of Trick or Treat was?
The Michael Dougherty one?
The one with the kid who wears a sack on his head.
Yeah, Michael Dougherty wrote and directed that.
Yeah, it made absolutely no money when it first came out, but it has gained an audience, and it has gained an audience a lot faster than it would have back in the 80s or 90s if it was only dependent on people physically, word of mouth, telling each other that it was good after they were able to get it on VHS. So I do have a spot of hope for things getting their recognition faster, and hopefully at a pace where the people who made the original piece can see some benefit from that. But for the love of God, people, don't forget that there are things that were made before you were born that deserve respect.
Well, and you also got to realize that the mainstream, as we're talking about here, are not exactly known for being fickle. These are the same people who made the Twilight book series one of the biggest selling books of all time. So we're not exactly talking about fickle people here, yet at the same time we are. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no. We have 50 Shades coming out.
Not my Christian. If you watch that's from last week tonight with John Oliver.
Yeah, I know. I catch you on the internet.
Well, because he's one of you.
Yes, he is. He's from Birmingham.
I thought they were
the Muslim.
Muslim
place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that place was all Muslim, I thought.
Oh, yeah. Can't go in there.
No-go zone.
No, I had to go in disguise all the other times I went into Birmingham.
Sarah just puts on a beekeeper suit. But,
An actual beekeeper suit. I don't have any other kind. I just have so many Halloween props.
You probably do, honestly. But, you know, to me, the mainstream, when something, and I know how arrogant this is, but to me, something that had a small cult audience, like when a cult film, a cult TV show, a cartoon, a comic book, band, whatever, when they go and achieve mainstream consciousness, whether it's through their own devices or not, something seems to be lost. Like, I'm going to bring up Hot Topic again. When you see, you know, obviously I'm a huge Iron Maiden fan. When I see Iron Maiden t-shirts worn by all the 16-year-old mall girls, and, you know, there's a dozen designs at Hot Topic, I don't know. It's not that it doesn't feel as special anymore. It just feels like it's watered down. You know, it feels like you're going to that bar that waters down the drinks. And nobody wants the watered down version of the product, do they? Sarah?
I think it goes back to what we've been massaging over this topic. You want people who have the representation of it to know something about it. You want the person who has an Iron Maiden shirt to actually know some of their songs, even past that, maybe have seen them live, so it inspired them to wear it, and not be the person who wears it because it says Maiden, and they're like, oh, it's for girls because it says Maiden.
Well, like an example, when I saw Motley Crue and Alice Cooper, I was sitting next to this one girl. I mean, you know, I have no clue who this is. It was assigned seating. To this girl who, through all of Alice Cooper's set, she's just kind of groaning, this sucks. They get to Poison, the one song that he had that, you know, was the huge top 40 song, you know, of the generation. She starts singing along with that, and then back to, what's this No More Mr. Nice Guy? Welcome to my nightmare? What the hell is this? And it's like, all she knew of Alice Cooper was his top 40 hit. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of like, why are you at an Alice Cooper concert?
Yeah. You know?
Just repeat yourself that he gets her ticket money, too.
I think she was there to see Motley Crue because she got up and did some serious fucking white girl dancing next to me through most of Motley Crue's set.
At
one point, I was
going to
call medical
that.
And see if she was having a seizure because this was some serious white girl dancing.
Well, you know what we used to do at the heavy metal concerts Donington? You see somebody like that, what you do is you get a bunch of you, you grab them, and then you throw them over to the security guards.
I thought you guys just pogoed, like from the old Sex Pistols concerts.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of that, but, you know, kind of forcing them to crowd surf towards the exit is always a good approach.
But I was kind of insulted. Like, you're here seeing Alice Cooper, mm-hmm. and you only know the hits. Mm-hmm. And yes, this is arrogant, but you're not an Alice Cooper fan then.
No. It's kind of funny. I mean, there is that sort of strange attitude that, you know, oh, yeah, I like the T-shirt. I like the kind of the fashion statement sort of thing. And, you know, actually, I mean, the Sex Pistols came from that, you know, regardless of how you feel of their legacy after that. They were essentially a construct by a fashion house. So you can take that for what you will, but when you get these people just wearing all this kind of stuff, and they want to go along to these things just because they can say, oh yeah, I went to an Iron Maiden concert, and they have no idea what the hell it is they're going to. Don't enjoy it. They just like to look the part. It's cheap and it's kind of silly, and yeah, it's rather insulting to the people who really do genuinely love that scene, because it's kind of intruding upon part of your culture when you have these sort of hangers-on who just go, oh yeah, it's cool at the moment, when, you know, 5 years down the line, not even that, probably a year down the line, those t-shirts are going to be in the bin and they'll have forgotten all about it.
It feels like it's being co-opted, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's in the worst way as well.
Sarah?
Well, I will say that I was suddenly the most popular person to talk to when everyone at work went to go see Guardians, and I got to explain to them why I used to mix up the Rocket Raccoon universe and Bucky O'Hare, because they had a lot of characters that were very similar.
Bucky O'Hare's
and
a bunny.
And they're like, oh, well, yes, but he fought okay, I'm not going into that right now. But he did have a girlfriend who was an otter that had a couple panels that were full frontal. That's all I'm saying.
Well, all right.
But if you have the right audience of people who have been inspired to know a little bit more about it, then you can jump on that and you can further educate them. It just depends how much patience you have and how much they're willing to actually listen. And that's all I can hope.
It's how much the studios and writers actually care about it from that point. Because let's face it, a lot of the Marvel stuff and the reboots of all that superhero characters tends to suggest that they're really just interested in making the money. They're not really interested in the story or the characters, because otherwise they would continue to develop along the same storylines, and I think that reflects the audience that they're pandering to.
I have no hope at all for a Batman versus Superman.
I would
rather just play the video game. Come on, that's all it's going to be.
That's the silly thing, isn't it? It's just making it bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And you wonder how far they can go when they just want to kind of pile on superhero characters into other characters' films and just kind of have this big mashup. And how much do we need to see that film? I'd suggest probably not at all, because it's all going to be about that one thing, that one scene, which will probably last about an hour. Like a Michael Bay film.
The only one I want to see is Marvel Zombies, because that would piss on everything that the mainstream audience knows about their Marvel characters.
Oh,
watching Spider-Man
especially...
dislodge his jaw and try to eat Aunt May's head to stop Ash from the Evil Dead from interfering.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. There has to be that scene where the zombie Howard the Duck is eating the ash from the current universe. And
he's eating his brains.
Yes.
I've often wondered how that happens because ducks don't have teeth. So
he could be a mutant. He could be a mutant who could have had his DNA readjusted.
Well, he
is. You can write your way around. Yeah, you can write your way around it.
All right. Well, to finish out tonight, Glenn, please tell us where we can find you and where people can see your nastiness.
You can find me on YouTube, the SlampyMan101, and also on Geek Juice Media.
Where can we find Sarah?
You can find me and my lovely, lovely pictures on 1201 Beyond. You can see other of my silly stuff on DeviantArt under Anna McKeon. And you can find me over at certain cafes at around midnight, just trying to get all this stuff done.
She works hard. She plays hard. And you can find me at 1201beyond.com. You can go buy t-shirts and stuff like that. You can contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. Guys, have a good night, and remember, just because it's popular doesn't mean it's good.
Just one problem. Is my cock big enough? Is my brain small enough for you to make me a star? Give me a toot, I'll sell you my soul. Pull my strings and I'll go far.
Is my brain small enough for you to make
my cock big enough? Is my brain small enough for you to make me a star? Everybody sing it one time. Is my cock big enough? Is my brain small enough for you to make me a star? Shut up and dance, everybody. Is my cock big enough? Is my brain small enough for you to make me a star? I'll sell you my soul. Oh, I sing that I'll go far. One more time, give me a tune. I'll sell you my soul. Oh, I sing that I'll go far. And true. My pillow.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.